We are so excited to announce that the Remedial Herstory Project will be having our first annual summer retreat coming to you in August of 2021. Join us here in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Kick back, relax, enjoy the spa, and a little bit of women's history. We are so excited to be bringing some of the best women's historians in the world to you. They are here to teach you the bits of women's history that you may have missed in history class, and we are here to guide you on the tools that you will need to get them into the classroom. The retreat is 50% pedagogy and 50% women's history. You will leave with dozens of printed lesson plans, learning materials, and tools that you can use. You can see the entire schedule of events on our website, as well as the names of some of the historians who will be presenting. www.remedialherstory.com. Look for the page about the summer retreat. Come relax and enjoy the White Mountains of New Hampshire with us.
Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode?
Today, we are going to be talking about the founding documents of women's history.
Founding documents.
Founding documents.
Deal. Amen.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
Enlightenment and women's founding documents.
Okay.
So, Brooke, on our podcast thus far, we have spent a great deal of time enumerating all the ways in which history teachers could do better at including women's history. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we need to remind ourselves and everyone that this is not only a problem in history class.
Right.
There are lots of theories and scientific breakthroughs that are talked about in science classes. And those theories are named after famous men and completely ignore the women that helped
promote that
theory or may have even invented it and didn't get credit.
This is my surprise face.
Yeah. Shocking information. This is true in math as well. And lots of the early mathematicians were educated by women, and that's should be frustrating to many of us. But in sticking to the social science theme, mm-hmm. in civics classes, as well as literature classes, one of the standards that's pretty much across the board is to first evaluate founding documents. And so when you hear founding documents, and when I hear founding documents, we think of that sort of the United States, right?
Yeah.
So you think Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, you might even go back further, right? Like the Magna Carta.
The Charter Oak.
Yeah. Yes. The Mayflower Compact.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And what's important to remember about every one of the documents that I just listed is that they were documents written by men, signed by men, and mm-hmm. not one of them had the intention of including women in this like new system that they were
building.
They're
not part of our society.
Right. So all of those that we just mentioned are part of an emerging Enlightenment or right in the midst of Enlightenment thinking. And so I want to hone in on that time period and look at some writing that women are producing about their station, and then end with the Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments, which is in U.S. history pointed to as this sort of founding document. And I want to be clear right from the start. With almost all of these, how widespread they were in their time is debated, but they were seen by later generations as important and significant and mm-hmm. foundations upon which women's liberation ideas were built.
Yeah.
So, all right, so let's kick things off with a woman named Olympe de Gouges. Olympe is spelled O-L-Y-M-P-E, but in French, it's pronounced Olympe. And she is obviously a woman from France. She is living during the French Revolution. And so let's get a little bit of background on the French Revolution. This takes place shortly after the American Revolution. In AP World History, we refer to this unit as sort of a revolution. Unit because there are a whole series of revolutions that occur around the world. The French Revolution is largely caused because the King of France, King Louis XVI, and his wife Marie Antoinette have essentially bankrupt the government. And France at the time had these three estates. The nobility The first estate was the Roman Catholic clergy that lived in France. The second estate was the nobility. And the third estate was basically everybody else. And everybody else was paying outrageous taxes to let the upper class, the first and second estates, live their wealthy lifestyles. And this was just really unequal and not sustainable system. Eventually, this leads to uprisings by the people of France against the government. The nobility in France refused to pay any additional taxes, and the peasants by this point simply could not pay any more taxes. The people of France, representing the third estate, petitioned the government, and King Louis denied this petition on June 17th, 1789. And so what the third estate did is a group of men got together and they formed the National Assembly. And King Louis basically said they can't do that, and he sends in the army to try to disband it, and this just lights a fire in the French people. And on July 14th, a mob stormed the Bastille prison in Paris, and they tried to take weapons, they freed prisoners, and this was the beginning of the French Revolution. Now, it's important to point out, because a lot of historians do not in their classrooms, that women were instrumental in this movement from the beginning. It is women who are oftentimes faced with the burdens of the taxation in the marketplace. And in the fall of that year, women actually had a full-on bread riot. This bread riot is oftentimes cast by history teachers as sort of this like random riot that occurred, but actually it was a well-organized protest by women. There were drums that brought everybody together in unison, marching on the market square. And there were about 7,000 people involved, men and women, but led mostly by women, to protest the price of bread and the scarcity of bread in France. These women need to feed their families, and they can't because the economy is in terrible disarray. So it's interesting, and I'll just, you know, we're a podcast here talking about women being left out, and PBS has this whole article that's pretty comprehensive on the French Revolution, and I will cite this in our show notes, and they completely leave out the bread riot, which most people consider one of the most important events of the French Revolution, and it's a massive riot. It's a huge and crucial part of Western history broadly. So the summer after the bread riot, the National Assembly creates a new constitution. The French citizens, as part of the National Assembly, drafted a document called the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And this is really important because Olympe de Gouges is going to take some of the language from that document and apply it to women. And so they write this declaration. The next summer, the National Assembly creates a new constitution and steals a lot of the ideas from the Declaration of the Rights of Man and include it in this new constitution. So the new constitution basically strips King Louis of a lot of his authority and gave all legislative power to the National Assembly, to that former third estate, if you will. The anti-monarchy feelings of the French Revolution are very different than some of the other revolutions that occurred during this period. And King Louis and his wife Marie Antoinette and their children are all directly threatened by this revolution. And they can feel it. It is in the air. And so they try to flee. And that act of trying to flee gets them dubbed traitors. And there's a lot more to that story, but to simplify it, they are captured and beheaded. Now, here's where I'd like to bring in my lady, Olympe de Gouges. Olympe is a French revolutionary. She was an illegitimate child. She was from southern France. She was a playwright and an activist and deeply involved in the French Revolution. She was a part of the Society of Republican and Revolutionary Women, which was a group of women in the French Revolution who formed to think about the rights of women. And they tasked her with creating a document. Writing a document that would represent them. So she did, and she stole the language that the male French revolutionaries were using and wrote her Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen. Now, this document is basically identical to the one that the men wrote, but this one includes women. And one author said, to highlight the confusing politics of the French Revolution, Gouges was hated on all sides. She was perceived as too radical by the moderates and as a royalist by the extreme left, probably because she dedicated the Declaration of Rights of Woman to Queen Marie Antoinette. Now, she did that because she was hoping that by writing this piece and including the name Marie Antoinette, she could appeal to her to take up the cause of women's rights and, you know, poor women in particular. And that certainly didn't happen, and neither women really benefited from this document being connected to them. So I want to pause really briefly and read a little bit from her Declaration of Rights of Women. She says, mothers, daughters, sisters, female representatives of the nation ask to be constituted as a national assembly. Considering that ignorance, neglect, or contempt for the rights of women are not the sole causes of public misfortune and government corruption, they have resolved to set forth in a solemn declaration the natural, inalienable, and sacred rights of woman, so that by being constantly presented to all the members of the social body by this declaration may always remind them of their rights and duties, so that by being liable at every moment to comparison with the aim of any and all political institution, the acts of women and men's powers may be more fully respected, and so that being founded henceforward on simple and incontestable principles, the demands of the citizenesses may always tend toward maintaining the Constitution, good morals, and general welfare. In consequence, the sex that is superior in beauty, as in courage, needed in maternal suffering, recognizes and declares in the presence and under the auspices of the Supreme Being the following rights of woman and the citizeness. Woman is born free and remains equal to man in rights. Social distinctions may be based only on common utility. Liberty and justice consist in resorting all that belongs to another. Hence, the exercise of natural rights of woman has no other limits than those that the perpetual tyranny of man opposes to them. These limits must be reformed according to the laws of nature and reason. The safeguard of the rights of woman and the citizeness requires public powers. These powers are instituted for the advantage of all and not for the private benefit of those whom they are entrusted. The Constitution is null and void if the majority of individuals composing the nation has not cooperated in its drafting. And that part, that bullet, is probably the most important one for what comes next. She ends with, women, wake up. The tossing of reason sounds throughout the universe. Recognize your rights. The powerful empire of nature is no longer surrounded by prejudice, fanaticism, superstition, and lies. The torch of truth has been dispersed on the clouds of folly and usurpation. Enslaved man has multiplied his force and needs yours to break his chains. Having become free, he has become unjust towards his companion. Oh, woman, woman, when will you cease to to be blind. What advantages have you gathered in the revolution? So those words are pretty bold and very important. Alamp de Gouche is arrested shortly after writing this piece, and among many others that she's writing during this period. She is unfortunately tied deeply to Marie Antoinette and is charged with treason in the tumultuous and scary thing which was the French Revolution. I read a transcript of her trial. It says that she was charged with having composed a work contrary to the expressed desire of the entire nation and directed against whatsoever might propose a form of government other than that of a republic. She was charged with having composed a work contrary to the expressed desire of the entire nation. They go through some of the documents that she wrote in order to better understand that. The public prosecutor started questioning her, and he says pretty overtly, there can be no mistaking the untrustworthy intentions of this criminal woman and her hidden motives. When one observes her and all the works to which, at the very least, she lends her name, culminating and spewing out bile in large doses. She then eventually is asked some questions. She asserts that she is a faithful patriot to the revolution. She says that she has always been involved in revolutionary acts and that these documents, she may have been mistaken, but they were intended to be, you know, an addendum to this revolution. The person writing the transcript said that the accused, with respect to the facts she was hearing articulated against her, never stopped her smirking. Sometimes she shrugged her shoulders, then she clasped her hands and raised her eyes toward the ceiling of the room. Then suddenly she moved on to an expressive gesture showing astonishment. Then, gazing next at the court, she smiled at the spectators. Eventually, the judgment is passed, and she is proven guilty, condemned to punishment by death, at which point she says, but wait a second, I'm pregnant. And so they say, fine, we'll send a doctor, a surgeon to inspect you. They inspect her, they find that she is not pregnant, and they execute her the next day. When they told her the verdict, she said, my enemies will not have the glory of seeing my blood flow. I am pregnant and will bear a citizen for the Republic. But nonetheless, the execution took place the next day, around 4 p.m., and when she walked up the scaffold, she cried out to the people, children of the fatherland, you will avenge my death. And people around her apparently cried out, vive la République, and she died. So this is a really important moment in the French Revolution, and the rapid executions that begin to follow as Robespierre begins the reign of terror in the months and years that follows, between 14,000 and 40,000 French citizens are executed. And during this time, a Mary Wollstonecraft happens to be living in Paris. And so she becomes the second woman that I'd like to tell you about. The Remedial Herstory Project is a nonprofit working to get women's history into the K-12 curriculum. Our goal is to create free learning materials for educators to use tomorrow. Head over to our website, www.remedialherstory.com. Download everything and give it to a friend. We need women's history in the classroom like yesterday. If you're not a history teacher and you want to do something to help us out, head over to our store. We've got all sorts of fun things for you to peruse, and all of that goes to supporting our mission. If you think what we're doing is needed, you can support the Remedial Herstory Project by becoming a sponsor through Anchor or becoming a patron. Patrons get access to behind-the-scenes materials, gear, bonus episodes, and more. Most importantly, they're putting their money where their mouth is and helping us get women's history into the classroom. Our Herstory Maker, Jeffrey. Our Herstory Heroes, Christian, Brooke, and Barbara. Our Herstorians, Jamie, Kent, Jenna, and Nancy. And our Herstory Allies, Nicole, Mark, Sarah, Leah, Anne, and Alicia. Thank you so much. You all make this show possible. I want to introduce you to a woman named Mary Wollstonecraft. She is British,
yeah.
And she wrote a piece called The Vindication of the Rights of Women. Have you heard of this piece?
I have, and her. She's bass.
Okay, so tell me what you know about her.
I know that she was aristocratic, though. She comes up from money, so she was well-educated, well-read, felt like she had some power to speak, and she used it for a lot of good. She wrote that document.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably her most widely published, but there's another one that she produced.
There's a bunch. Vindication of the Rights of Men as well.
Yep.
Which is interesting. She is a writer, and she has a publisher that she works with
yep.
for years. And so that sort of gives her this platform and actually makes her pretty widely read in mm-hmm. her time.
Yeah.
So Mary Wollstonecraft was in Paris during the French Revolution and was around it during the time when Olympe de Gouges was executed. And it is the spirit of the revolution and the execution of Olympe de Gouges that she writes her Vindication of the Rights of Women. Now, she had already written the Vindication of the Rights of Men, which is a reaction and a commentary to build off of things that were being written by Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine out of this time. And so she was contributing her ideas and her interpretation of these Enlightenment ideas to the philosophical thought. And so her Vindication of the Rights of Woman are just an extension of those ideas and saying, yeah, all of that and add women. Mary Wollstonecraft, as a British citizen, was safe while in Paris because she had been in a relationship with an American man, and they faked a marriage, even though they weren't married, in order to protect her. They had a child, which was deemed illegitimate by society at that time, and eventually traveled back to Britain, and he sent her on a mission to Scandinavia, where she wrote a bunch of very emotional letters and pieces that were later published about love and emotion, and those were later read by a friend of hers who was also a journalist. The two of them fell in love and eventually got pregnant, and so they quickly got married. And during that time, they lived separately. They both wrote a bunch of pieces, and she had their child in August. They named their child Mary Wollstonecraft, and she died some days later from a fever that she got from childbirth. Now, her Vindication of the Rights of Women is very differently received than Olympe de Gouges. It was actually widely accepted. Only one person was really critical of it when it was initially published. What happens is that when she dies, her husband posthumously publishes a bunch of her pieces, and he writes basically a story of her life to try to support the cause of women, to basically say, look, she had this relationship with a guy who did not support her and their child, and this is the plight of women. This is the plight of unmarried women, and they don't have a lot of options, and this is really problematic. And even though his intentions were good, the reception that this received in the community was to basically discredit her. Here is a woman who lived outside of societal norms and, one evil human, I can't even think of a better way to describe him, one evil person said that her death in childbirth was basically God's punishment for her feminism, essentially. And interestingly, her daughter, Mary Wollstonecraft, the second, if you will, goes on to write as well. And she writes a book called Frankenstein that all of us have heard of or seen or read in some shape or form. And the American and world literature teacher down the hall told me that of that time period, she's the only one that continues to be read widely. In the U.S., the reaction is not as immediate. And but the ideas that are put forth both in the rights of the female citizen as well as the vindication written later, those same ideas are embedded into the Declaration of Sentiments that mm-hmm. is written at Seneca Falls 50 years later. And so this document at the Declaration, the Declaration of Sentiments, which is written at Seneca Falls Conference is convened by Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and some other abolitionists turned suffragists, and they meet in upstate New York. And this initial women's rights convention is where they write this declaration, and they basically say, you know, stealing some of the ideas from these preceding Enlightenment thinkers out of Europe, man has not treated women well in this country. And they lay out a list of grievances, just like the Declaration of Independence had done.
I mean, it's very organized.
It's very organized. So I think these documents are just such a really powerful way to talk about the way, the agency and the ways in which women have always or have advocated for themselves right. in the light of Enlightenment thinking, in light of emerging democracies. And they should be things that students are reading and are analyzing in class, especially when they garnered such profound and horrifying reactions
right.
in their time.
Right.
The Declaration of Sentiments, one thing that I find really interesting about that is that a lot of the women who signed it, actually, when they finally went home to their spouses or fathers or whatever, redacted their signing in the days that followed because they were like, oh, just kidding, that was a little too bold of me.
That's interesting.
It is interesting, and I think it shows how challenging it had been for women to stand up. That document in particular, you know, again, wasn't that big of a deal in its time, arguably, but in retrospect, it became a big deal.
Well, yeah, because not only did you put your name behind it, you had to stand there with it and take the bullets and take the consequences of your name being on that document and what it might do to your husband's, you know, business or career or what it might do to your children and your family. And it's a lot.
Yeah. So I have pulled together a lesson plan for people that basically lays out modified versions of the and translated versions of these three documents. And they, you know, really lay out and are very similar to one another. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when we read the Declaration of Independence, you can hear Lockean ideas embedded in it. And shouldn't women have the same opportunity to hear the Enlightenment ideas from their European sisters across the pond, mm-hmm. talking about these
Absolutely.
Things and the ways that women across borders can have solidarity with one another.
Right.
And
similarities, no matter the government.
Right. And we spend a lot of time in government classes and in literature classes talking about the rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence and how powerful and ahead of its time it was. And I think the fact that these documents were so controversial and maybe the fact that these documents were so controversial during their time should tell us a little bit about
yeah.
the boundaries that they were pushing about the role of women and the rights of women and the view that the society at large, women included, you know, had about women having those rights. And why not give students an opportunity to read founding documents that did include women in them instead of just having the caveat of, well, and of course we know that that didn't include women, but whatever.
Yeah, why not actually show what they tried to include?
Yeah.
It's impressive. It would be I think about it from like an unconscious bias perspective and lens is you take that document, make it about men and see if anyone has a problem with it.
Mm.
It's like, well, then now it's all about women.
Yeah.
Where does your lens go?
Right.
So men were allowed to see these things, but women were not.
Right. Well, and there's parallels between, it, you know, in the French Revolution, between the document that the men produced and the document that Olympe produced. And in the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence and the Declaration of Sentiments, the parallels are abundantly obvious. And it would be a really powerful lesson, I think, to juxtapose those documents and have students look at it. But I also think a question worth asking is, are there any rights listed here by these women from the 1790s and 1840s that still have not been achieved or moved? And I think you will find that there are some. In the Declaration of Sentiments, it talks about, you know, making her feel worthless. And, you know, part of this podcast's aim is to undo this idea that
the value of women is lower than men.
Yeah. And we should be including them in our curriculum.
In all things.
Yeah. And in all things.
Amazing. What an interesting topic.
Thanks, Brooke.
Yeah. Thank you, Kelsey. I'm Brooke Sullivan.
I'm Kelsey Eckert.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.